Tonight we're going to continue with our learning of Rus, but I'd like to, before we even start, just to contemplate perhaps just in our own lives before we even enter. Last week we talked about the balance between helplessness and decision making. If we want to hone that a little more, a lot of times in life we actually don't make decisions. A lot of times in life we let life make the decisions for us. So let's say we have a very pressing decision that needs to be made. A lot of us will wait and wait and wait until the circumstances will either weigh in the one direction or the other to a point where there is not really a choice. Procrastination helps solve a lot of issues, because by the time you procrastinate long enough, you get to a point where life really essentially forces your hand in one way, and then you are able to say, well, you know, I had no choice. That's a lot of times what unfortunately ends up happening to us. You know, in a way that I remember reading this in Stephen Covey's book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. He remembers that, you know, a student puts up their hand, and I think it was when he was a student, and he was trying to explain to a teacher that he wasn't able to go to class because he had to go to this tennis game. So the teacher said to him, no, you don't have to go to the tennis game or the tennis practice, whatever it was. You decided that you have two values. You have going to class or tennis practice for the championships. And you made a decision that the one is over the other. Don't allow yourself to be the person in life where life is forcing you and you're always saying, well, I had to make that date, I had to have this meeting, and therefore you're in a certain sense saying, well, I'm not really a present party of the decision making, I'm letting life do that for me. So with that in mind, like just that thought, let's dive straight into Rus's conversion and try to deepen it in terms of what we understand that happened and also contextually what was actually going on. Okay, so in terms of Nach as a whole, I'd like to dig back with a very, very fascinating parallel. So the question that was really raised last time, and the question we need to think to ourselves, is a very basic question on a Mefarshim level, and that is when did Rus actually convert? Okay, when did Rus make the plunge, and this was it for now on inwards? So you look at the Psukim, you get different indications. What does it sound like? Just from what we've spent time learning last week. Last week we spent a little bit of time learning a little about the road. She's walking with her mother-in-law. She's walking with her sister-in-law, and they're walking back towards the land of Beis Lechem Yehuda. And there's this whole discussion. So when does it sound like she converted? Right. So if you look at the Pesukim, sounds like. So Dina's isolating Pasuk Tes Zayin. Vatami Rus Altif Ki'ibi Lazeich Lashuv Me'acharayich. So it sounds like when Rus really puts her foot down, when she says, I'm not going to be deterred, I'm not going to be pushed away, and she relentlessly holds on after the third time that Naomi tries to push her away, it sounds like that's where the conversion process is happening. Right? And she and then in Pasuk Yud Ches is where it sounds like Naomi is relenting and no longer pushes her away. So this is what the Psukim seem to indicate. The only issue is that really, 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 we need to think about this from a context perspective, and that is that they did marry the children of Naomi and Elimelech, right? So what happened then? You know, Machlon comes back from university or wherever he was. He was out at a restaurant and he said, you know, Dad, Mom. Well, actually, it was at this point there was no Dad. Mom says, I met this girl. She was something else. Her name was Rus, and we just got talking. And what happened afterwards? Meaning, was there a marriage? Was there a conversion then? Is there anything to indicate that maybe something happened earlier on before this? I mean, now this is a question we never really thought of. But what's going on in their lives till this point is what should really be in the background over here. And if there was something earlier, then what's going on over here? Meaning, what's this whole conversation about? If the conversation's been had already when Rus says, now listen to me, let's sit down, I want to explain something to you about your culture and your lineage and your people, right? So what happened when is what the Mefarshim are trying to struggle with. So on that, the Mefarshim are really divided. Let's say, here's how the division runs. If you zip to page 14, Rashi and the Malbim on the one side are very emphatic. Rashi and the Malbim say the following. This is the very, very bottom of page 14, source 2. Rashi says, in Pasuk Yud Beis, Ki zakanti mi'as le'ish, she says, Naomi says, I'm too old to remarry. I'm too old to have children. you should marry, that there wouldn't be a prohibition of marrying for him to marry the wife of his brother, that was no longer there, who needs you. So Rashi says that no, you know what happens? When they got married to non-Jewish women, and that was it. There was no halachic form of marriage even. There wasn't kiddushin. If you go back to the words in the psukim, just to corroborate what Rashi was saying, the word in the very, very first page we went to, Pasuk Dalet, how does it describe their union? The word it uses is Vayis'u lohem noshim u'avyos. The halachic word used to describe marriage in the Torah is Lekicha. Later might be consummation, but Lekicha is actually Kiyikach ish isha. That there is really the union. Now this of marriage in a halachic sense. Now it could mean that they're living together and they've set up home and they're renting an apartment together. But what Rashi's telling us is that there was no marriage, halachically speaking, and there was no attempt at geirus up to this point. And that's what he says. Now is when the conversation begins, which makes it all the more shocking, according to Rashi, because then that means to say that the level of depravity, so to speak, you know, or identity depravity, we'll talk about that was occurring beforehand, was so fast. Meaning here you have leaders of a community isolating themselves from a community, the head of the family dies, and in a split second, we see them already marrying out without even the thought of saying, you know, let's do gefilte fish on Friday nights or anything else. There doesn't seem to be anything else that's happening in the according to Rashi. Completely shocking. Similarly, that's why when the Rashi we studied last week, remember Rashi was talking about how every statement that Rus makes, where you go, I go, where you sleep, I sleep, where all those things were where she was trying to have a conversation with Naomi, saying, I know, I get this religion, I want to be part of this. Why? Because according to Rashi, what's happening? She is now having the discussions of conversion completely for the first time. This is when it's all happening according to Rashi. Unbelievable. One second, let's get to the end of this thought. The Malbim, in fact, drives us in even further in source 4. It's in he's really on Pasuk Dalet. He says, it's on top of page 15. He said that he continues to say that their sin, meaning we try to understand, two weeks ago, we were trying to say, well, what did the boys do? You know, after all, you know, Elimelech moved the whole family. He is liable, he dies. What the boys do? So we talked about how they carried on in the same trajectory. They sort of they solidified their mortgage out there in Stamoth. However, he's saying, no, it's worse than that. Part of the reason they were punished was because not only did they live there, that they decided to marry into that culture. They left their values behind at the doorstep. And that's where he quotes the Midrash. He says, And he talks about how Lekich and Nesiah are the same. And he goes and brings another proof from Tanakh, but later by Nehemiah and Ezra's time, where there was a lot of assimilation and intermarriage, where the same word is used to describe intermarriage. So pretty shocking description over here, but it sounds like this is what the Psukim are describing. It sounds like the whole discussion of Judaism in the girls' lives really only begins actually as they need to really make that decision, when life forces upon them the decision of in or out, which is really happening on this road over here. Is the Ibn Ezra takes a completely different track. He says the Psukim, in fact, as opposed to sort of emphasizing the whole discussion now, he says the Psukim emphasized that it was much earlier. Take a look at this Ibn Ezra. On the next source, in source 5, he's going to really pull us to the other side of the spectrum. He says, so he goes on in 1 second. So he says that on at the end of the first line towards the comma, he says, Uvidrash Omer, Shehem Yoash Vesraf. That Machlon and Kilon really had other names, and their names were Yoash and Seraf. Because they married the daughters of Moab,
Israel,
ki Amoni. Shloyavobikal. So he says that they knew that you couldn't marry Moabite men, but they knew that the women were in fact allowed. So therefore they were actually marrying in because they knew there was acceptability for the females of Moab to enter into Israel. The Shloyichu Mibnos Israel, Vesever Israel Voir Zevetuv. So he says that no, there was actually a level of they were doing this actually cognizantly with the idea that they wanted these women to actually marry into Israel. And they knew that there was a halachic process and a loophole for the women. He goes on. Yes, so he says further on, in the next source, the very end of the next paragraph, the last line, he says, "V'lo yitachen." Do you see it? The second paragraph of source 5, the last line, he says, "V'lo yitachen is not possible." It's not possible that they married them when they were not Jewish. They must have converted. And the proof in the pudding is El Amar the El Eloheha. When Naomi says, "Return to your people and your gods," what she's saying is essentially return back to where you were, the decision that you already made. So what he views as going on over here is that something had happened and that something was being reversed now on Orpah's side and Rus was really cleaving to it. And that's what he says, on that pasuk itself. In the next source, he says, El Amav El Elohea to her God and her gods, her people and her gods, La'ad Shinis Gairu, the ones that she had before conversion. Completely different way of looking at it. Says Ibn Ezra.
Doesn't it have to be that way though? Because otherwise there wouldn't have been any Ibn and Chalitza, there wouldn't have been any obligation on a non-Jewish woman.
Right. You know, you're right. You know, Sister Marjorie, you know, what the expectation was on these women and what they were trying to think or trying to really correct, it's hard to know because already the Yibum concept is a little bigger than the, you know, prescribed Yibum. It's more ideologically Yibum, so to speak, we're going to see. So even that is, you know, it's much more of a chesed than a strict, you know, kiyum of that. But you're right. The further we place them from Judaism, the more of a jump it is for them to make. The closer we place them, the more responsibility they have, and therefore the more of a turnaround Orpah is making. That's sort of the push and pull that we have in these directions. So now. So let's put this all together. So what the Mefarshim are arguing, what the Mefarshim are struggling with is if you look at these psukim, there's a lot of pushes and pulls in either direction. Because on the one hand, it sounds like the conversation is happening now, but then how do you understand what happened beforehand? Did they not have a discussion beforehand? Could they possibly have converted? Who's their gods and returning to their gods? That's what the Mefarshim are struggling with. So I happen to see that there is a response from Rav Moshe Sternbach on a halachic discussion. Because there are different types of conversions which can take place. You know, and we'll call them conditional conversions that he's talking about. Conditional conversions mean, let's say you have a family that converts, and you have a child that converts with them. So what's called ger katan, right? So you have a family and there's a child. So the child can, you know, say Torah tzival anemoshe morashakil asyakub. That doesn't mean that they have a choice. So, you know, in many cases, as long as the family is keeping by the main tenets of Jewish faith, and the child reaches a certain age, we say the child is going to be given a choice, and usually the child will say, yes, I'm in. But there's a sort of conditional conversion waiting for the stage where there's a real commitment. And what Rav Moshe Sternbach says is that maybe what's happening over here is the psukim are deliberately ambiguous. Maybe the psukim are deliberately ambiguous because, of course, something happened. Of course, some conversation must have had, which is towards where even Ezra's pushing. There must have been something where there was some level of cultural commitment. It may have even been a serious cultural commitment. But until the point that it was actually tested, until the medal was ever placed in the heat, this was never really, we never really solidified, the decision was never really made. So the psukim might be conveying exactly that tension, that they did make this commitment, but you see that Orpah's commitment was only as strong as a regular wind blowing. Once we start getting to the gale force, and now life, so to speak, forces us in a certain direction, then she recedes back into her past life, which is what we talked about a little bit over here. So maybe exactly that's what the psukim are conveying, is this sense of tension, which is where Rus is. Let's dig it a little deeper, in fact, because there's something quite remarkable, and I didn't put this into the books just because I was only fortunate enough to discover this. Just over the, when I was doing new research on these psukim, and I thought this was really quite something phenomenal. I just traced back a little bit of lineage over here for a moment, and I think this is quite remarkable if you bear with me for a moment. So let's trace this back. Let's just get the family of Avram Avinu in order. Okay, when he was still Avram. So the way it works is Avram's father is Terach. So Terach is the father, and listen to the way the Pesukim described. This is the end of Bereshis. Listen very carefully to how it's described. So Terach lives for 70 years. Vayolad is Avram, es Nachar, ves Haran. So he has three children. He has Avram, Nachar, and Haran. Great, so we know that part. Then, Va'ela told us Terach. Terach holid is Avram, es Nachar, ves Haran, v'Haran holid is Lot. Okay, so we now have, we have three children. One of them has Lot. So Lot is Avram's nephew. Okay, so he is the nephew. Vayamas Haran apenei Terach aviv. Haran predeceases his father. Be'eretz molalatabu urkastim, in urkastim. Vayikach Avram v'nachar lahem nashim. And now the remaining two brothers marry. V'shem ha'eshes Avram Sarai. He marries a woman called Sarai. V'shem ha'eshes Nachar Milka. And the name of Nachor, the other brother's wife, is Milcah. But now we're told something extra. Bas Haran, who is the daughter of Haran, which means that who is Nachor marrying? His own niece. Milcah is the sister of Lot. And then Milcah va'avi Yiska. And Haran was also the father of a third sister, whose name was Yiska. Who is Yiska? So the Midrash says that, in fact, Sarai and Yiska, for interesting reasons, are in fact the same person, which means that the two remaining brothers married their two nieces. Right? So not just out of interest, not just also not only Avram's nephew, but brother-in-law. Okay, just that part isn't emphasized in the Pesukim then. But so what that means to say is that, and if you think about this, right, well, the way our foreman goes about this, that we're not going to follow on this so much now, but is ultimately that's almost a reverse Yibum, if you think about it. Meaning, what's going on over there is the lost brother, Haran's lineage, which is hanging in the balance, is being taken under the wing by the two remaining brothers. Right? There's something interesting going on over there in terms of continuing his name. That's what we have over there. Fascinating. Okay, but now what troubles everybody is you know, the Torah doesn't add in unnecessary detail. So what happened to Haran? Right? Meaning, okay, so, you know, it's wonderful to know that there was a Haran, but, you know, why was it that he predeceased everybody else? So the Midrash tells us, the Midrash fills us in on this place, and what exactly did happen to Haran? Right, so we're told, in trying to understand what happened to Avram, the Midrash Rabbi says, the famous Midrash says that Avram Avinu was very, very ardently, passionately monotheistic. And that was not... that was not so culturally accepted at the time, and so his father was embarrassed or angry, and took him and presented him for in front of Nimrod, who was the ruler of the time, and Nimrod made a pretty simple decision model for Avram to see how monotheistic he really is, and that is the fire or your the fire or your beliefs, and he chose his beliefs, jumped into the fire, and that was it. Now the problem is that when you have in society, when you have a family which is already creating problems, you want to make sure that no problem is left. So the Midrash says that it wasn't just Avram who was given the choice. The whole family, you know, all the brothers. So Haran was also told, you know, you have to decide about your belief system or not. And so the Midrash says that Haran, in fact, was sitting on the side waiting to see what the outcome would be. You know, saging. If Avram dies, that's not a good idea. If Avram wins, then we'll do this. And in fact, so Avram walks out unscathed, unburnt. And they say to Haran, what about you? And he says, I'm with him. And in he goes, and he was killed. Right? So, meaning to say that Haran's belief system wasn't based on a necessarily ardent, passionate belief. Rather, it was what seems to be the winning horse at this point in time. So, in fact, the Shemesh Shmuel, the Sokotra of Rebbe, who lived just about a century ago, points out a very fascinating thing about Haran's name. If you look at Haran's name, it's made up of three letters, which are all middle letters. Okay, so let's think about this. The letter He is 5. That's the numerical value of 5. 5 is directly slap bang in the middle of the tens. Okay, so 5 is our bridge number, our He, halfway to 10. Then if you take the next letter, which is resh, why is resh? Resh is the numerical value of 200. Why is 200 a middle value?
Because there are only four of the 100 letters, and this is the halfway mark.
Fantastic. So if you go to the Aleph Beis, the biggest single number, the biggest single number that the Aleph Beis presents to us is the letter Taf. That's the highest we can go, and that is 400. So the biggest numerical value that there is in the 100 scale is 400. Resh is directly in the middle of that. It's the 200. Nun, of course, is 50, which is in the middle of the 100. So the middle of the single units, the middle of the double units, and the middle of the triple units as far as the Aleph Beis goes to its maximum based on one letter. Which means that his name ultimately describes an individual who is a fence sitter. Right? Meaning to say, the description of his name is a person who sways in whichever direction, and he swayed in the wrong direction, or the right direction for the wrong reasons, essentially, in this particular case. And that was his downfall. Not for now. What the Shem Yishmael does do, and this is worthwhile thinking about, is that the name Aharon, of course, is Haran with an Aleph, which means to say that there's a guiding principle in front of balance, which leads to a peacemaker. Isn't that interesting? So do you see, compromise is Aharon is the person who's able to forge compromise, but that's because he's a value-driven compromise as opposed to a simple blown in the wind. Okay, do you see an interesting pattern emerging there? But that's not what's relevant for us right now. What's relevant for us is that the prototype of Haran is our in-between man. So now what is fascinating is the following. If you look at all of our patriarchs and matriarchs, interestingly enough, all the patriarchs are, of course, from the line of Avraham, right? Avraham, Yitzhak, Yaakov. Where do all the matriarchs come from?
Haran.
They all come from Haran. Because think about this. Sarai is Haran's daughter. Who is Rivka? Rivka is the great-granddaughter of Milka as well. The end of Parshas Vayera tells us that this is the lineage of Milka. And the great-granddaughter, the granddaughter is Rivka. And then, finally, who are Rachel and Leah? They are, of course, the nieces of Rivka. Lavan, also from the same family line, which means that our family structure in Judaism, ultimately, comes from the merging of the side of Avram and the side of Haran, fusing together on the male and the female side, almost directly down the middle from both those sides. Fascinating. So now, let's push that a little further. I wonder, this is just fascinating to think about, is you see that the same decision process of Haran is going to be played up again and again, and a decision has to be made on the behalf of his descendants as to in or out. So we see immediately happening after the whole Haran episode is, Avram is told, Lech Lecha, Avram, you've got a mission. You've got something to do, you've got to change the world. And who goes? Avram and Sarai and Lot. Now, interesting, isn't that interesting? Lot now, the son of Haran, is seeming to be, you know, he seems to be a step forward. He's going, he's sacrificing everything. He's going as Avram, he's going with Avram. He seems to be on the mission. It seems like he's taken the proactive step to be with the Abrahamic mission. It's either, you could say, he's following in the footsteps of Haran, or maybe even better than that. Because you see, when it comes down to the Egypt situation over there, and Pharaoh wants to know what's going on, Lot is, Mum. He doesn't say anything. He doesn't let the cat out of the bag. And in fact, he's rewarded because of his protecting Avram in the very precarious circumstances they go down to Egypt. So Lot seems to be on the right path. But what ends up happening? Lot is presented with a fork in the road. You see, the land is not really supporting both of them. And Lot's Lot's shepherding policy doesn't work so well with Avram's shepherding policy. So what ends up happening is, Avram says to Lot, this is I didn't put this down, but listen to the words he says. There was a fight. Don't let there be a fight between the two of us, says Avram. Between our shepherds. We're brothers. Separate from me. Doesn't this sound familiar? Here we have the Naomi and the Rus. Isn't this interesting? And of course, Haran is, if you think about this, great. Remember, Lot is the father of Moab, who is the patriarch of Rus and Orpah, right, on this side. So now, interestingly enough, he has our original flash of the scenario happening. He says, separate from me, You go right, I go left. You go left, I go right, says Avraham Avinu. Notice the word over here is to separate is hiparet. Hiparet actually is an interesting word because it actually is also the root of the word mule. Preda is also a mule. Mule is an interesting animal. It's a combination of a horse and a donkey, and it is sterile. Right, it is not a creative creature. It is a creature which has a unique function, but remains sterile. What's Avram essentially saying? He's saying, look, it's not working. It doesn't look like you're going to be part of our project. And you're not part of the project. So Avram is saying we're going to be going in different directions. Lot does not push back. Lot essentially lets reality dictate the decision, and he says, you know what? I'm going to go to Sodom. He goes to the complete opposite ideological place in the world of Avraham Avinu, and he moves off to Sodom. The meeting happens, he has to rise to the challenge, and in fact, he slips back down from the challenge of, are you going to join yourself with Abrahamic legacy? Take it a little further. When Avraham saves them from the whole war of the four kings and the five kings, the one thing you don't notice at the end of the war of the four and five kings is Lot saying thank you and not hanging on. Lot goes very happily back to Sodom. Then when the angels appear and say to save Lot, it's fascinating that as much as the angels want to save him, it doesn't sound like he and his whole family are very excited about the whole prospect. In fact, he has two sons-in-law and daughters who decide to stay. They're quite happy in their environment, meaning even when they're being wrenched out and the decision has to be made, there's a very hard cultural twisting which is going on over there in Lot's own life. And in fact, his wife, I wonder if that's what's happening with Lot's wife, is when Lot's wife is turning around, what's happening? She's caught in that same fork again, where Lot are being asked the question is, where are you going? Are you attached to the Abrahamic dynasty or a legacy? Or are you really sort of ebbing off into a different train of history? And that's the turning around which Lot's wife has to experience. And Lot is finally able to just make it, to be able to get out. And then Lot continues via Sodom, Moab, and Ammon. And let's take it even further. Now, I thought this was just fascinating. This recreates itself again twice. The one is when Eliezer walks down next generation, and Eliezer is looking for the wife for his master's son, Yitzchak. So here comes Eliezer, he walks in, he asks for a sign, the sign is fulfilled, he meets the girl, he gives her the presents, he goes back to the house, there's a whole long description of his trip again. And then he wakes up the next morning, and the words he says is, they go to sleep at night, and he says, send me back to Abraham. And Lavan says, the brother and the mother say, you know what? Like, what's the big rush? We just met you yesterday. Abraham sounds great, but you know, let's think about this a little bit. So what is Eliezer saying? Eliezer says, don't delay me. I have providence on my side. I'm very clear this is the right thing. I'm going back to my master. And in fact, Rashi says that there's a veiled threat there. He says, meaning to say, I'm going to, I will find a wife elsewhere for him if you're not going to accede. And they said, no, you know what? Let's call the girl. What are they doing? See what's happening over here? They're saying to the descendant of Haran, Rivka, they're saying to her, Rivka, we're putting it in your hands. Do you want to be part of this or not? Do you see what's happening over here? The same question which was asked to Haran, the same question which was asked to Lot twice, is being asked to Rivka. Are you going to go or you're not going to go? Are you going to stay with your family or are you going to join this Abraham business? And what happens? Rivka breaks the cycle. Rivka is able to go, like the Sarai who went with Avram, like the Lot who tried but failed to go with Avram. Now we have Rivka going. And they send her and her nurse, and then they say in the next pasuk the blessing which we say, all parents say to their daughter as she goes to the chuppah, which all experience this, At Hayil Alfei Revava. You will be the matriarch of tens of thousands of people, the Yirash Zarecha Shara Sonov, and your descendants will inherit their enemies. Because meaning this decision, the courage they saw, they wanted her to stay, but the courage they saw in a woman who was able to break the tide of fate, so to speak, or gravity or inertia, is a woman worthy of this blessing. And it comes up one more time. I think this is where it's once more fascinating. Next generation. Next generation, what happens is Yaakov Avinu descends back to the same place. He's back in the house of Lavan, no longer Pesuel, the house of Lavan. He marries two daughters there, again the daughters of Haran, essentially. He's marrying Rachel, or Leah, actually, and Rachel together, right? So this is what happens. He stays there, he works for the 14 years. He works for another 6 years, and in fact, he invests in, and he gets a great investment, and he's able to get the right reward for his work. But then the pasuk tells us, this is in Perek Lamed Aleph, "Vayar Yaakov es penei lavon v'ineinu emor kitmol shilsham." It's going too well for him, right? His salary is not as Lavan expected it. He wasn't banking on Yaakov walking away with this amount of sheep, and Lavan's face is turned. "Vayomer Hashem Yaakov shuva eretz avosechum la'atzdecho v'yayi emor." He gets a dream at night, and Hashem says, "Yaakov, time to go." What do you think Yaakov does next?
Yes.
Right, he doesn't get up and go. He asks his wife. Okay, very important lessons over here. Vayishlach Yaakov vayikra laRachel leLeah haSadel tzono. So he calls Rachel and Leah in, and he says, "Vayomer lohen ro'eh anochi es pnei avichen ki enenu it alai kitmol shishom." I'm looking at your father. It's not the same attitude he has to us as before. Ve'lokei avi hayamadi, and I had this vision from God. Listen, I really worked for your father. I put in everything, every blood, sweat, and tear into your father's work. And your father cheated me so many times. But and he says, and he presents all the times that he cheated him. And the angel appeared to him, and he says, and he explained the whole thing. And he describes this all to them. Vatan Rachel v'Leia, and Vatoman Eloi Ha'od Lo Nuchelik V'Nachal Lo Beveis Avinu. They say, are we really part of our father's house anymore? That we are considered as outsiders. And I think that, you know, we pass over this. This is the end of Parshas Vayetze. It's been a long Kriyas HaTorah. And we don't necessarily realize the gravity of that decision. The gravity of the decision. They have it fine for them. They have it made. They're being supported by their dad. You know, I wouldn't say Yaakov was learning in Kollel exactly. But everything's fine. And what are they essentially doing? They're breaking the ties. They're moving away from the current of where their family is once again in almost the same way that Rivka was doing, which makes them the tikkun, the fixing of what Haran was essentially failing at. I think that it is interesting to me that in the Megillah over here is when the great 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 granddaughters of Haran, who come from Moab and Ammon, who are in fact very much his family, so much his family that come from his own daughters. Now Orpah and Rus are faced with the same question. And Naomi is saying, look, the goings aren't good. And back home, the goings are ostensibly good. After you came from some form of nobility, the question is going to be, where are you going to land? Are you going to fall back into the inertia of where you are, the culture that you perhaps may have committed out of, but only tangentially, or are you going to make that jump? And when Rus says, Amech Ami, the Rus Dov Kabah, and Rus cleave to her, that is ultimately the correction. It's the two sides of those family coming together once again for the communion of what's going to really be almost now the patriarch and matriarch afresh. It's the Avram Avinu, it's the Avram and Sarah, it's the Yitzhak and Rivka, it's the Yaakov and Rachel Leah, which is being recreated over here. So I think this is just adds a lot of depth to our Rus's decision, which is quite remarkable. What we have ahead of us to try to think about very carefully is now as they walk back into Beis Lechem, now the as brave as a decision Rus had, now she's going to have to actually face the journalists.